Hi, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Raven Reviews Discussion Series, brought to you by the Raven Foundation. The Raven Review is an online magazine where you can read articles and watch interviews like this one about mimetic theory, religion, politics, pop culture, and family life. But today, I'm so excited because we have with us John Stonecipher. Hi, John.
Hi. I'm excited to be here. Good to see you.
I'm excited to have you here. I'm excited. I wanted to bring you on because you are doing fantastic work on your Facebook page and social media, getting people to talk about serious issues, specifically about politics. And we've just had this very divisive political election, and people are hurting, and all kinds of emotions that people are having. And you're doing what I think is a really fantastic job of giving people kind of a safe place and outlet to be able to talk about what they're feeling and their hopes and their fears. And I wanted to come and talk with you about that and what you've learned about the process, because I think it's just an amazing job of what you're doing.
Thank you. It's fun. It's interesting.
Yeah, good. So I want to invite everybody to go over to John's page and friend John and read what John has been doing, because it's just fantastic work. But before we talk about that, John, I want to kind of give people an introduction to you and who you are and what you're about. You were a pastor for a while, right?
Yeah, I had 7 years of that, from starting at age 21, which turns out was a little bit young for that. So it was rough. It produced mixed results, but I'm a civilian now. I'm really happy with it.
How did you find yourself being a pastor at age 21? That is awfully young.
Well, I grew up in a church that was a good church to me, and when I was in college, it ran on some really difficult times, and you could say either God called me to pastor it, or I felt like I needed to save it. So the line between ministry and savior complex is complicated.
It's a thin
one. So that was how that went, and I learned a lot, and I did a lot of good. So yeah. Stuff I regret too, but you know.
Awesome. Good. Well, and then after you were a pastor for those 7 years, what did you do next?
Then I got back into just technology in general, and that's kind of been where my career has been. Running technology for people who need it run for them. And I work in oil and gas and environmental law right now. I don't know anything about the topics, but I know how to keep their computers running and make their microphones work.
Yeah, nice, awesome. Well,
I'm not doing that great of a job with this, but.
Well, we've had a few technical difficulties, but we've made it through. And currently you are working for the law library in Denver, Colorado. Yeah, nice. And you've taken some time out of your lunch to be with us, so thank you for doing that. Really appreciate it. So you write and you do speaking at conferences. You write at geekedoutsoul.com. And on your Facebook page, you also do this project, Jesus Ben Yosef, which is just also fantastic. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I don't publicize myself as the author of it very much. It's not a really well-kept secret. But what it is...
Did I just out you? Because we can cut that out if you want.
I've actually been outed before. It's okay.
Okay.
I started this probably about 3 years ago. I opened up a couple dozen Facebook accounts in the identities of several New Testament characters, most notably Jesus. And they've been going through Jesus's ministry purportedly in real time, and I cycle through it every 2 years actually now, so I have to squeeze certain bits of it. The first year of that ministry, there's not a whole lot that goes on, so it's really boring. John the Baptist will pop up now and then and say something really offensive, but Jesus didn't have a whole lot to say, so I've squished time a little bit, so now it's a 2-year cycle. And now we're... I guess this is our second cycle through. We're close to the end of the second cycle. And people interact with Jesus just beautifully. You can friend, anybody can friend him if they want. It's Jesus Ben Yosef with an F at the end, which just means son of Joseph. And he looks suspiciously like the guy from Lost. So if you see him, that's who that is. Although he has David Duchovny's nose photoshopped onto his face.
Nicely
so
done.
Like, if it doesn't look quite like Desmond from Lost, that's why.
I like it.
So, but yeah, that's him. Most of his followers have no interest in being Christians, which I think is so cool. And he gets all the right responses. The lowlifes absolutely love him. We have a wonderful time. And we have some kind of fundamentalist folks that pop on there, and it's like I don't even have to ask them to play the Pharisee part. Sometimes they just do it, and sometimes they actually deliver like the exact right line. Like I was going to have to get, you know, log into my Pharisee account and come in and talk to myself really weirdly that way, but then somebody I don't even know pops up and says exactly the right thing. So yeah, we have a lot of fun.
Do you call them a brood of vipers?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And John the Baptist is not averse to the word asshole either. I discovered that just channeling the character. I'm like, wow, this guy goes farther out than I do. So that's that project. No, that's really fun.
It's just you have all of these wonderful creative projects that you do. What was your goal with Jesus Ben Yosef? Did you have a goal, or was it just?
Well, the goal partly was, like, I'd been studying my New Testament and read all the N.T. Wright that I could and various things, and I felt like I kind of had a handle on the New Testament and Jesus in particular, and I'm like, okay, I got to test this out. How am I going to do it? And that's my test.
Yeah.
Like, can I deliver every line that Jesus delivers and still feel like some inner integrity to the character? And are people going to respond to him in the way that people respond to Jesus? That's my attempt at being a scientist.
What have you learned? What have you learned in the process?
I've learned that Jesus is much more willing to offend people than I am.
Yeah.
That I really try to indwell his character a lot, and sometimes I know exactly what Jesus needs to say, and it's not what I would say, but I have to say it anyway. Yeah, he doesn't really care about pissing people off and letting people walk away, and that's really not me. I'd be, you know, the rich young ruler would come and talk to me, and he'd walk away sad, and then I would just chase him and say, come back, I'll do whatever you want. But Jesus just kind of has to stand there and let it happen. So that's been new.
Wow, that's really cool. You also have a project, We Make the Road with Kids.
Oh, yeah, that thing, yeah.
Which goes off of Brian McLaren's book, We Make the Road by Walking, right?
Yeah. I really wanted to start going through some Bible stuff with my kids. I have a 14-year-old, a 12-year-old, and a 5-year-old. Kind of broad. And I realized they weren't really getting my love for the Bible into their life. Like, I had spent a lot of time, like, whenever I'd read the Bible to them, I'd have this little bit of snark in my voice because there were bits of it that bothered me, and that couldn't help but come out in this passive-aggressive way. And so it's like that's the Bible that they were getting from me. So I just decided to try a new tactic, and Brian's book seemed like a really good opportunity to do so, but it wasn't really written for kids. So I put together, just for my own use, just some YouTube playlists, pull in different movies and books. Like, we have a manga Bible that we read alongside it, and just a lot of different resources that I pulled together to just make it so that we can have a conversation, me and my kids. And I know my oldest son, when I told him the story of Jericho when he was little, he cried. He's like, is God going to come and destroy my house? And I'm like, oh, you're having a wonderful reaction to this, son. I agree with you. I don't know what to do with it. And then my youngest son, when I told him about it, he just, like, yelled and screamed and was like, yeah, get up. Very different children. I'm still working on his violent tendencies. Yeah, we're hoping that'll work, and I won't regret this.
Awesome.
Like, you know, yeah, that'll teach you to read Joshua to your 5-year-old.
Right? Yeah. So I've... I have children, and I was listening to a podcast with Walter Brueggemann. And Walter Brueggemann was like, yeah, God does all this violent stuff in the Old Testament. And my son was like listening in the background in the car, and he was like, God doesn't do that. God can't do that. God's love. And I'm like, oh crap. What have I done?
Yeah, in those situations, I've learned to just say, that's a really good point.
Yeah, Let's talk about that. Yeah.
I feel like I've had to stop letting myself be scared of questions.
Yeah. So instead of being scared of questions,
we talk back to the Bible, and even Walter Brueggemann taught me that.
Yeah.
Talking back and engaging in contestation is the point. And that's what I teach my kids, that if you want to fight with the Bible, you fight with the Bible.
I love it. It's what the ancient rabbis did. They were always arguing with the text, and we somehow missed that in Christianity along the way, or at least in evangelical Christianity or American Christianity, whatever you want to call it. There's this tendency to not want to argue with the Bible because it means that you're doubting it, or I don't know, something like that. But to be able to tell kids, to give them the freedom and ourselves to be able to argue with the text is a great spiritual practice to do, as opposed to avoiding it.
Yeah, yeah. In our house, we say that we have a dialogue God, not a monologue God. And that our Bible is not a monologue Bible, it's a dialogue Bible. It's people dialoguing with each other, and we're a part of that dialogue.
That's fantastic. I love it. I love it. So if people want to check out your work on that, where should they go?
That's a wonderful question. Probably their best way to get there would be to go to my blog, which is probably the least active of the various projects that have spun off it. But it's geekedoutsoul.com. And in there, pretty prominently, you should find a link to subscribe to the newsletter. It's an email newsletter. And we also have a secret Facebook page that if you contact me, I can add you to it. But it's a secret group because it's made up mostly of people who would get fired if anybody knew that they were in it. So if anybody wants to join, they can. You just have to ask me. You won't find it by looking for it.
Awesome. Sweet. Well, I wanted to talk with you about your project on your personal Facebook page about politics and listening to one another. Why did you want to start this? What was the impetus behind this?
Well, there were a couple things. Several years ago, I started to realize it was in the years of George W. Bush, actually the years after, where I started to realize how much of my politics happened in my brainstem, how so much of politics wasn't just emotion, but it was my reptilian fight-or-flight response that was getting triggered constantly whenever anybody said anything. I mean, like, I could feel it vibrating in the back of my head, and it started to strike me that any kind of political discourse I'm having, it floats on this ocean of emotion. And there's just these little rafts of attempted rationality that I have. And there's so much energy behind anything politically that we discuss with that has nothing to do with facts or with rationality. And I started to recognize that. And what I realized, what was bothering me about the people, my friends who are politically different from me, I wanted them to empathize with me. I didn't just want them to understand what I was saying. I wanted them to get that deeper context of simple fear and desire that was underlying it all, that I had a vision of things that was beautiful to me and I was drawn to it, and that my vision and my being drawn to it did not make me a bad person, even though I was voting differently from them. And I also started to realize that it was the same on their side. That I'll tell you a story about how this came about. I had a bunch of libertarian friends, and I have my libertarian side, but it wasn't very strong. And I'm like, these people are either evil, crazy, or stupid. They're one of those three. But then I became a fan of the show Firefly by Joss Whedon, and in it, it's a story about some regular people trying to get by in outer space, but they were under the thumb of a really oppressive, nasty empire of jerks and assholes. And the whole show was lived under this oppressive shadow. And in the course of the show, I just loved it. But it came to me, this is how my libertarian friends feel. They feel like they're just trying to get by, and they're being weighed down by this system that doesn't notice them and doesn't care about them. And it has all this rhetoric about being a good empire, but it's not. It's oppressive. It's nasty. And I didn't necessarily come to agree with my friends about their judgment of things like that, but I called them on the phone and I'm like, I get it. I think I get how you feel. I feel like in my gut, like I don't hate you. I don't think you're bad, and I don't think you're stupid. You see things this way, but I feel what you feel. And I have not been able to scapegoat libertarians ever since then.
Wow. How did you get
to them on that level?
Yeah. How did you get to the point where you were at, okay, I want other people to empathize with me, but then you had this switch where you were able to empathize with your libertarian friends. So it became about empathize with me, and then it was empathize with them.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean? Like, how does that happen?
The thing that was necessary before it could happen was my decision to not believe that my friends, people I knew, to not believe that they were evil, crazy, or stupid. There are a lot of forces that militate toward getting me to stop believing all the things I know about my friends, that if they're voting for the wrong person, that means that they're not entirely human, that they're bad somehow. It's like, wow, I thought you were a great guy, but you're obviously racist because you voted for that person and not this person, that kind of thing. That there is a lot of automatic judgment that media and parties teach us to have. And I decided that I wanted to be more loyal to my friends than to my ideology. I believe in my ideology, and I'll fight for it, but I'm not going to give up on my friends and on being loyal to them as people.
Wow. Yeah, that's powerful. I love it. And part of how you're not giving up on them is listening to their voices, which is what you're doing on Facebook, right? And what's fascinating to me is, as you say, the media tells us what to think, and we tend to pick and choose the media and the people that we follow on Facebook, which means you do get this echo chamber, this kind of relationship with those around us that just reinforce our views that those people are the bad guys and we're the good guys and we have to fight against them. But you're using social media and Facebook in a radically different way. And it's fantastic. So you start off on November 9th, the day after the election. And your first question is, if last night surprised you, it's because you were hit by something you didn't see coming. What was your blind spot? And right. This is like the blind spots that we all have. What did you learn from asking that question?
Well, I learned that not everybody was ready to talk about it right then.
Pretty wrong.
A week. I mean, like, I don't know if you noticed my Facebook page the night of the election, but I was basically live blogging Ezekiel, where I like just was reading through Ezekiel kind of on a whim, and I just got to all these points about how, you know, woe is us, we're going straight to hell, our whole country is going to be destroyed. I mean, I was just going at that for like a solid 2 hours. Ezekiel is a difficult place to be on a bad election night. So, you know, I go there as much as anybody does. But yeah, as I calmed down a little bit and realized I didn't understand my country, like I thought I knew how things could possibly go, and I was wrong. And just the existence of that blind spot told me that I need to see something that I'm not seeing. And I knew the only way to see it was through the eyes of some friends who I had not had a good relationship with for the past year because of stuff that happened. And so, yeah, I wanted to ask questions. And the blind spot question, most of the answers I got was, my blind spot was I didn't realize how racist our country was. I mean, and it's not that that's invalid, but I felt like the blind spot was bigger than that. Like, my blind spot wasn't that, wow, I have a whole lot of racist friends. I think I have some friends who aren't as aware of privilege as I think they should be. And I see them making decisions that I think are very destructive because of that. But I couldn't let myself go to that place of, they're bad people, unfriend, right? I couldn't go there because I know my friends. Even the ones which I just don't get because of how they vote.
Yeah.
And I knew I had to learn some things from them to understand them, or I was going to just start dehumanizing them.
And, so that's,
and when it comes to shooting, I expect them to not shoot me. I've told them this. Like, you know, if I'm ever brought in front of a firing squad in front of you, I hope that you don't pull your trigger. And some of them have said, I promise I will not pull the trigger. Who knows? We'll see how that we'll see how that goes.
Yeah. So besides, one of the things that you do that I really appreciate is that when people start getting upset, you put on the brakes and you say, let's just listen right now. This is not the time to attack the other. This is the time to listen to the other. And this I think is one of the blind spots that we have, the reptilian brain that you're talking about that just goes on the attack and doesn't put on the brakes. And you're modeling how to do that, and I really appreciate it. You ask a few times, dear pro-Trump friends, and this I think is so essential to just go after this. What is it that you are hoping will happen? What have you learned from being in dialogue with pro-Trump friends?
I've learned, okay, even more than learning anything, I have gotten in touch, in regards to my pro-Trump friends, and I have more of them than I thought I did.
Yeah.
I got into their shoes at an emotional and empathic level that I hadn't been before, and I began to experience America in a more realistic way than I had before, because there were feelings out there that tend to be that people will hide because those feelings aren't acceptable. And if you read Walter Brueggemann, you know that if you take your emotions and you bottle them up, they're going to come out in violence eventually. And that's why the Bible models for us the taking of all the crap inside you and letting it out in prayer and even in worship. You know, the Psalms about, I hate your babies and I want to bash their brains out. Terrible psalm. But if that's what's inside you, it has to get out. And if it doesn't get out in words, it's going to get out some other way. So in talking with my pro-Trump friends, I got in touch with a lot of frustration that is out there among a very broad swath of people that I had previously dismissed. That my friend in Texas who is very uncomfortable leaving her house because of groups of young men standing on the street corner who are speaking Spanish. There was a time when I would have dismissed her as merely racist. And I think there's issues in there still, and I don't want to discount those. But I grew to connect with her and her fear and anxiety and her frustration that the place where she lived didn't feel safe to her anymore. And how sad and how powerless that made her feel. And the fact that I feel that, and the fact that now she knows that I feel that, takes a lot of the energy out from behind the heated political discussions that we might try to have. that because I'm feeling what she feels, because I'm empathizing, and she knows that I'm empathizing, we're able to talk all of a sudden, and we weren't before, because all of that was bottled up and coming out in all kinds of stupid ways that weren't productive.
Yeah, well, we've got a question in the chat room from Suzanne. She says, can you talk more about anger? I hear you saying that anger can be a sign of scapegoating. I agree with that. Do you see a positive use of anger, prophetic anger, maybe? How does it show up differently than scapegoating anger?
I've thought about that a lot, too, because honestly, I still have plenty of anger. I've listened to my pro-Trump friends, and I've learned some from them. Some of what I've learned, I've just learned what's inside their head. I don't think I've learned that much about reality necessarily, because I still don't agree with them. And I think this presidency is going to end badly. I don't think it's a good thing. And I am angry about that. I intend to stand against every bad thing that I see this movement trying to do. And I intend to keep feeling angry about that. But that anger is going to be anger at real things rather than mythical things. And by mythical, I mean, you know, I have this idea of Satan in my head, and I'm, as a human, I'm constantly looking for someone to fill that role so that I can do battle with Satan. And I need to remember that I can stand up to the Satan without hating my pro-Trump friends. You know, as Paul said, we're fighting with principalities and powers. And I want to stand against evil without turning my friend into the enemy that needs to be destroyed. Because when I go there, when that's the kind of anger, when it's a mythical force that I'm trying to embody in this person, that's when I become able to kill that person for the greater good. And that's where I don't want to go.
Yeah. I'm also intrigued because when you're talking, as you're talking, there's also a sense in which it's prophetic anger is not always against those who are other. It's against our own people. Like, what have we done? Where are our blind spots, right? This is the blind spots question. Where did we miss the mark? And there are two things happening here. When you're listening to the other, there's a risk that your friends are going to call you a traitor. And also when...
Oh, yeah, definitely with that.
Right, you get that a lot. Jesus gets that a lot, right? And
that's what I'm trying for.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is one of the most important things that the ancient Hebrew prophets tell us, is the problem is not so much with the Assyrians or the Babylonians or the bad guys out there. It's what we've done. And when you do this, your friends may come after you. You've experienced that.
Yeah, for the most part, people get what I'm trying to do, and they respect it a certain amount, or at least enough to not attack me directly for even trying. That's not always true. Some of them are just quiet and ignore me, and that's fine. I'm looking at Suzanne's comment that the problem comes when anger is coupled with hate.
Right.
I think that's right on it. Somewhere that I think anger and hate are not the same thing. I'm not done thinking about this yet. I don't know if you can tell.
Yeah. No, these are big issues, and you're wrestling with them, and it's fantastic. So a lot of people decry Facebook and social media for saying that you can't have real conversations. What are the good things and what are the bad things? What are the risks about using social media to have these kinds of conversations?
Well, I think on social media we're so separated from each other that it's easy for us to be absolute assholes to each other, mm-hmm. in ways that we never would be in real life.
Yeah.
at the same time, that's also part of the virtue of it, that you feel safer saying things when you have two computers and a lot of wires in between you and the person that you're talking to. Sometimes, like, you know, text message is a nicer way to have a hard conversation because, you know, nobody's going to punch you. Or you don't have to look your friend in the eye and see everything going on with them, and that might make you unable to keep talking. But that's just been my experience. I'm probably just a communication coward. But I think what's been necessary, and I think this has been the magic key, is that I've been trying to use social media to love my enemies, and I've translated that into providing hospitable space for my enemies to be heard. Because I think when my enemies are heard, a lot of the heat goes away, and we stop feeling like enemies. That's been kind of my guiding principle, that I want to love my enemies, and what that means is providing space for them to be heard, because they need to be heard just like anyone. And I think if our national conversation had been functioning better over the past few decades, I think this election would have gone differently. I think there would be, what is it that Martin Luther King said, that riot is the language of the unheard. And I feel like the Trump phenomenon is a riot of people who feel unheard. Whether they're unheard or not is another question. They feel unheard. And if they didn't feel that way, things might go differently. A different kind of conversation becomes possible
when they feel heard. Does the conversations that you've been having give you hope that people can start hearing one another? Like, are people, when they're responding on Facebook, do they just talk past one another, or are people hearing one another?
Both. Some are able to hear, and some of them don't. One question was, dear pro-Trump friends, are there anything about the things that Trump plans to do that you think are a bad idea, or you don't like where that's headed? Is there anything that you don't like about that? And I asked the same question of the other side, very careful to do that. And there were some who just had the knee-jerk response of, no, nothing is wrong about anything that he plans to do, even though nobody really knows what he plans to do for the most part. You know, the people who had these really knee-jerk responses, what I'm hoping is that eventually they'll be able to look back at that response and notice that that was really, really stupid. And people answered that way on both sides. And that, you know, I asked, okay, anti-Trump friends, is there anything about the Trump presidency that you think might end up being positive? Is there anything positive that you have to look forward to? And there was a share of people, absolutely not, nothing. I mean, and that's when you know you're getting into mythology rather than reality. That, no, Satan is president. How is anything good going to come from that? Right? I'm hoping that some people will be able to look back at that and think, you know what, that wasn't quite right. And when, we'll see. I don't know.
Yeah. Going back to this prophetic question, we've had quite a few people asking us at Raven, how do you stand up for justice during these times? What's difficult about this is that often when we stand up to Trump or his policies, he ends up being able to play the victim in such a way that gives him more power even than what he had before. So it's this very tricky situation of how to fight for justice without feeding the beast, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
Did you have any?
Just because someone's a scapegoat doesn't mean they're innocent.
Yeah. No.
I think we scapegoat Trump plenty. That doesn't mean he's making good choices.
Yeah.
And what I'm saying about trying to differentiate the real from the mythological is kind of what I'm trying to get at there. That I can go up against policies and speak as prophetically as I damn well please. But what I don't want to do is scapegoat and hate and become indifferent to facts.
Yeah.
You know, if a good policy comes out of a president that I have very few positive feelings for, that doesn't make it a bad policy. And it's that that I'm trying to keep my mind open to. And that, to my liberal friends, that sounds like betrayal.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm okay with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I want to be, if nothing else, I want to be the person in the crowd not throwing a rock.
Yeah.
That may be the height of anything that I can accomplish, which is next to nothing.
Yeah, and the risk is if that you don't join the crowd, then the rock could be thrown at you. So, I mean, this is just what happens. So, Lindsay says, listening to our enemies as a means of loving them. So simple, it's brilliant. Thank you for that.
Thank you, Lindsay. That's a good way to say it.
Yeah. It gets back to your point about empathizing with the other. It starts with listening. Yeah.
And I want to go at it without the kind of naivete that says, oh, Trump is fine. It's okay. Nothing can actually go catastrophically wrong. Nations can exchange hateful words without devolving into civil war. We're fine. That wouldn't happen to us. That's not what I'm preaching at all. What I want to do is approach people who are against me and are against the marginalized. And I want to face them as someone who has already dealt with fear. That I want to wake up every day and embrace my life and my death and go face whoever there is to face. And not have that be a thing that's controlling me from the background. I mean, that's really easy to say.
Yeah, hard to do.
Yeah. I want to be realistic about what people might do and still be at peace and be peace in the midst of whatever I find myself in.
Yeah, I love it. Lindsay says, listening to our enemies as a means of loving them is brilliant. I also love what you say about not scapegoating or being hateful towards facts. When someone you don't like or usually disagree with has a good idea or a good policy, you acknowledge that. I think that's so important, and it goes both ways. So that we need to be critical of our guys when they are wrong. Yeah, it happens. I mean, this is, I don't know what Lindsay exactly is getting at, but Barack Obama's drone warfare has done a lot of damage in killing innocent civilians in the Middle East. And to me, that just sows more hatred in the world. So that's again, getting back to being prophetic is much more about being prophetic in our own houses, I guess.
Something I was taught in therapy is to, you know, be you, be truthful, speak the truth as you know it, but let go of the outcome, because the outcome doesn't belong to you. And part of what that means is, like, you know, there are certain things that I'd like to see happen in the world and in our country. And I'm going to say what I say and do what I do. But if I have the sense that I have the right to move the world in my own image, when I fail at doing that, that creates a lot of anger in me. And it's the kind of anger that can go in really bad directions. And when I'm prophetic, I'm not working for this party or that party and try to get this person elected and that person not elected. Instead, what I'm trying to do is speak the truth. And truth is powerful in its own way. And the arc of history bends toward justice. And I have to trust that, because if I don't, I'm going to start feeling justified in all kinds of horrible things against the bad guys.
There's a certain amount of faith that you're pointing to about where the world is going. The universe bends, the arc of the universe bends towards justice. And oftentimes it feels like it's hard to see that. It's hard to have faith in that. But where does your, I would imagine that your experience with Jesus Ben Yosef has helped you out with this a little bit?
Nobody listens to him politically. But by which I mean Jesus is not in front of a big voting bloc at all. He tends to shrug off things that would be recognized as politics, that, you know, Caesar doesn't like me, okay. You don't want to pay taxes, okay. He seems to focus on other things. He says stuff, but he doesn't expect anybody to elect him to any particular office. He has more important things to do. I don't think Jesus avoids politics. I think he has a more realistic estimation of what politics can do. And he's involved in something much deeper and much bigger. Maybe you can call it deep politics rather than regular politics. Maybe that's what I'm trying to do.
What is the kingdom of God? I mean, this phrase has political overtones to it. Kingdom of God. What is Jesus? That's the bigger picture, I think, that Jesus is getting at. But what does that mean for you?
It means the triune life of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, desperately and hopefully in love with each other and having a wonderful time doing that. All of that getting birthed in the spaces in between people and animals and plants and rocks. All that beauty, that harmony, that creativity, that peace, and intimacy finding its way into every crack of the universe, and where the love of God flows through human tubes, that our connections with each other are incarnations of the connections between Father, Son, and Spirit. That's, you know, my big fancy theological definition of the kingdom of God. And the only way to do that is with specific people. And it's that I'm trying to do on Facebook. That you are voting in ways contrary to me, and I think they will go badly, but you are my friend, and let's go have a beer, and let's not avoid each other. That's what I think is important. I think that matters at least as much as my vote does.
Yeah. Wow, that's a beautiful vision. We've got one last question from Suzanne. What do you think about Christian support for Trump? Do you find out anything about that in your Facebook conversations?
Those are actually the comments I have the most trouble holding back from. They hit a little too close to home, just because that's the world that I'm closest to. I want to control their minds more than I want to control most. You know, if I could reach into their head and turn it around, I would. Whereas, say, my atheist friends, I have less of an urge to do that with, and I'm more comfortable with them being distinct from me. What do I think about it? I mainly just feel about it, and I feel very sad.
Yeah. And you give it up, and you participate in this thing that Christians call the Trinity, and that's the love that flows through the world and listening to others as you go through it.
Yeah, and I try to let that flow even with my Christian friends that I feel so far away. If the church is not a place where that conversation can actually happen, I think we're failing.
Yeah. And the church should be a place where, as you're doing on Facebook, where everybody feels safe and we can have these kinds of conversations. So thank you, John, for modeling that for us. If you want to go interact with John on Facebook, you can find him there. You can also find him at geekedoutsoul.com. Anywhere else people should look for your work, John?
That's pretty much it.
There's pretty much other stuff
that I don't put, there are places I don't put my name on, and that's intentional. But
good.
The main one is Jesus Ben Yosef. So if you want to hear me trying to act like God, that's where you want to go. And I'll tell you that, it's really fun. When I started Jesus Ben Yosef, I really thought, like, oh no, this is just going to be a Jesus character who talks like John Stonecipher. And the funny thing is that he so doesn't.
Yeah.
he's such a strong character that I go and try to inhabit that character, and he does things that I would never do.
Lindsay says, do you ever find yourself disagreeing with Jesus Ben Yosef? Like, are there times when you realize that what Jesus says is not what you would say?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
All the time. I'm kind of following I just picked a harmony of the Gospels, just so that I don't miss anything that he says and go through it in a purportedly chronological order. I don't pay that much attention, but I don't want to leave out anything that he says. And he says some stuff. Really, like, what in the hell are you thinking? I mean, and, you know, and he calls the Canaanite woman a dog. I mean, and then she calls him out on it, and he's like, you know what, you're right. Which I love. I think God likes it when we argue with him. If we don't get anything out of the Bible, we get that. But then there's other times where he says stuff where I'm the one saying, how could you say that, dude? And I don't know what his response to that is. Maybe I just don't get it. But I'm finding each time I go through the cycle, I feel like I'm getting a little bit closer. Like something that was hard for me to have his character say in the last cycle, you know what, I can do it this time, and it feels like the same guy that he really is. It's not like some split character where, okay, he's in mean mode right now. Because he's talking about how you're all going to die. I mean, he even says, you know, Jerusalem's going to burn and how I wish the flames were already kindled. This guy's pissed off. And one thing I did in Lent last year that I thought everybody was going to hate, but it was really popular, that I had Jesus preach through Jeremiah. And, like, I'd skip things here and there, but, like, you know, it's kind of a chapter a day, where Jesus would just basically perform that chapter, kind of in his own words, and I had fun with it. And Jeremiah is dark. But what came through was Jesus being realistic about the civilization that he was in, and that he saw the way that it was going, and he knew where it was going to end, and it angered and grieved him. And that came out in his preaching of Jeremiah. Which is exactly how it went for Jeremiah. And maybe that has something to say about what it means to speak prophetically. That Jesus spoke against the system of his world, but he also wept over it at the same time. Maybe if I can do both of those, maybe I'm on the right track.
It's very creative and wonderful thing. So thank you for your work and everything that you do. So, and thank you for being with us here and talking with us about politics and how to listen to one another and also work for justice at the same time.
It was great to talk with you. This was really fun.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And thank you for everybody who's watching and in the chat room and for your questions. We will do this again soon. Until then, grace and peace be with you. Bye-bye.